We call them man's best friend. We let them sleep in our beds, eat out of our hands, and regard them as part of the family. Australia has one of the highest household rates of pet ownership in the world at over 60%. In 2016, we spent over $12 billion feeding and caring for them. What is our obsession with pets? Joining me today on Open for Discussion is Dr. Anne Fawcett from the University of Sydney's Faculty of Science. She's researched extensively on human and animal interactions and veterinary ethics and is passionate about translating animal welfare science into real-life recommendations. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Anne Fawcett.
Thank you so much, Chris.
I've never interviewed Dr. Doolittle before, but it sounds like we're pretty close.
I don't know about that. I can't talk to animals. I wish I could.
Well, we'll see. By the end of the podcast, you know, anything's possible. So, Anne, can I ask, how did you come to this area of research?
So before I did veterinary science, I actually studied philosophy, and I was really interested in a very obscure area of philosophy, which was 17th century metaphysics and ethics. And I got to the end of that degree and realized when I went to the Career Center that actually it wasn't a lot of work in that area. And philosophy really is a tool that's meant to be applied to other things. And one area that I'd loved all of my life was this idea of working with animals. So I thought, I'll see if I can get into vet science. Lo and behold, I did. And I studied to be a vet and loved it and have come full circle and now interested really in veterinary ethics. The other thing that has interested me since the moment I was born is the question, what is a good life and what is life about? And I really don't think you can answer that question without looking at other life forms. So I studied veterinary science, I became a vet and became really interested in veterinary ethics and human-animal interactions. It's fascinating.
It is. What interests you about human-animal interactions?
We're all life forms on this planet, and who knows what the purpose of that is, but it seems to me that my worst nightmare would be living a monospecies existence. There's so much to learn from these other beings, and the way we interact with them is telling a lot about us as well.
What do we know about how animals feel and think? From your research, what do we know about these other species that we live with?
Actually, quite a lot. I think we were held back for many years when science really had this view that you couldn't talk about animal emotions and animal thoughts. And because we had no direct access to their subjective experience, we couldn't infer that they really had one. But I think that's been overturned now, well and truly. Animal welfare science has established unequivocally that animals feel emotions. They can feel positive and negative emotions, just like you or I can. Maybe they don't think in the same kind of language that we do, but certainly their behavior indicates that they can have good and bad welfare states, and they have interests in achieving certain things and doing things in their lives just as we do. So there's a lot of similarities there.
So Anne, I understand you have a new book.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about it?
This book, it's called Veterinary Ethics, Navigating Tough Cases, and it was co-authored by Dr. Siobhan Mullen and myself. Dr. Siobhan Mullen is from Bristol University, and she's a real pioneer in the field of animal welfare science, ethics and law, and it was fantastic to be able to work with her. We wrote a whole lot of scenarios based on very real life cases and ethical dilemmas, and then we put them to a whole range of experts from around the world. So veterinary ethicists and even medical ethicists, we have laboratory animal scientists, all kinds of people looking at these dilemmas and showing the readers how they reason through them, which we felt was an important resource because it's really hard to suggest just blanket rules about dealing with some of these dilemmas. They're so very different.
Is there a top dilemma or are there a couple dilemmas that you could share with us that are in how they were dealt with?
Yeah. So, well, we went from some really big philosophical questions like whether animals are slaves or not. That's a question that's being asked, and I guess by groups like PETA, for example, who are quite influential. Professor John Webster, who's the father of the five freedoms, answer that dilemma. And we also had Emmanuel Geoffrey, who was formerly from Voiceless. He was the legal counsel for Voiceless, answer the same dilemma. And they both had very, very different views. John Webster argued that animals weren't slaves at all, and Emmanuel Geoffrey argued that, in fact, they are, and that we really need to be rethinking our relationship with animals. So I think that's a really provocative and interesting question. That it's a little more esoteric in a sense, because your average vet who's dealing with patients in practice is more likely to come up against dilemmas where particularly the interests of the animal owner or guardian are in conflict with the interests of the animal. So an example of those dilemmas would be convenience euthanasia. Now, in veterinary circles, convenience euthanasia refers to euthanasia that's performed, and it's really not euthanasia, it's killing, I guess, that's performed for the convenience of the owner. So, for example, an owner is going away for 6 months overseas and can't find anyone to look after the animal. It's a 3-year-old healthy dog. Let's euthanize the animal. Let's kill the animal, and therefore there is no issue. And that's something that's faced by veterinarians reasonably regularly in practice, and something that causes a whole lot of moral stress. The advantage of our book, I guess, in dealing with these issues is that there is a recognized mental health problem in our profession. Vets are up to 4 times more likely to commit suicide than someone in the general population.
Okay.
It's really, really high. And part of the issue, we think, is this moral stress, feeling conflicted about the right thing to do in certain situations.
You've mentioned that animals are really quite complex. So talk to me about pet ownership. If we know that animals are so complex, how do we justify owning pets and keeping them in our home?
That's a really good question. And that's one that a lot of people are looking at right now, actually, Chris. So pet ownership still is a form of animal use, but I think it's really evolved. I think that it's become a form of companionship. And James Serpell, who wrote the book In the Company of Animals, talks about mutualism. So pet ownership is justifiable if it's mutually beneficial. So beneficial not just to the human who gets the companionship and all of the health benefits that are established around interacting with animals, like lower blood pressure and fewer visits to the doctor and all of those things, but also the animal gets something. They have their needs and wants and welfare requirements taken care of. So my personal view is I think that it is justifiable if we make an effort to meet the animal's needs and ensure that they benefit from that relationship.
But is it, I'm going to take the devil's advocate position here. Is it mutual if the power dynamic isn't mutual? If you can lock a dog in your house, I mean, you tell them when to sit, you tell them when to heal, you tell them when to pee. I mean, isn't there a power dynamic issue here that means that it's not entirely mutual?
There's absolutely a power dynamic issue, but I guess it's a theoretical question, isn't it? Because what would be the alternative? We live in a world that's dominated by humans, and one of the ways that animals can flourish is when they are taken into human care. These are animals that have been domesticated for years and years and years. There's recent literature that shows that, in fact, cats probably kind of domesticated themselves alongside humans, and so they may have had some choice in the matter. And I think that when it comes down to the day-to-day needs of animals, they're still better off when they're in human care than when they're not.
Okay, I'm going to push back again. You know, because we do this with orcas. We say, well, you know, the orca was injured. We brought it into the marine park. It's now been here too long. It's been being fed by humans, so it can't survive on its own in the wild, and so therefore that justifies us keeping it in captivity for the rest of its life. What's the difference?
Yeah, well, I think first of all, I want to talk about the similarities between, say, dogs and orcas, and there's many. They're both really complex creatures. They are sentient beings. They have memories. They learn. They're social animals. It's much, much harder to meet the welfare needs of an orca than it is to meet the welfare needs of a domesticated animal like a dog, for example. The other issue for me is that with marine mammals, humans are actually much, much less adept at interacting with those animals in a way that can be satisfying to those animals than we are at interacting with dogs and cats and other domesticated species. So that would be a factor as well.
You know, I understand, and I want to certainly draw a distinction between pets and service animals, because I have a completely different position. The devil's advocate position is completely different with service animals. I don't think there's any problem with people who have needs working with service animals.
That is interesting, because that's actually been raised in the ethical literature. And some people who find it acceptable to look after an animal argue that service animals are, it's more of a slave use of animals, which is really interesting. I don't agree with that position, but that's certainly been raised in the ethical literature, because the service animals are working all of the time.
Where I'm, you know, I guess I just don't, I think that there's a lot of gray in here, and I think we've come across quite a bit of it just in our conversation. What about fish? Because I was doing, you know, I study sharks, and I did a little Googling, and I was like, what's the top pet sharks? And one of the top pet sharks was actually a wobbegong, and I wouldn't have thought that that was a good shark to have, because they can get quite big. Yeah. So if you've got a little tank in your house, it could outgrow it quite quickly. Any thoughts on wobbegong, or any thoughts on sharks as pets?
Well, sharks as pets, I think, would probably be very unsuitable, because I think that it's really hard for most people to meet their welfare needs in terms of the size of the tank, the enrichment. We know from studies that fish are incredibly intelligent. That whole goldfish has a 3-second memory thing is a load of rubbish. It's one of those urban myths that's kind of had its own life. What we know is that all kinds of fish learn socially, they can feel pain, they can learn to avoid pain, they have memory. They're quite intelligent in ways that perhaps we haven't allowed, and need to still engage with those animals in ways that I don't think people are so aware of. So I get a bit nervous when people talk about keeping wobbegongs or other animals that are a little more exotic as pets.
Can I follow up on a point that you made about cats and how they might self-domesticate? Can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, it's really interesting, because we tend to think about the way dogs have been domesticated. It very much became part of human societies and used by humans, and they were working and so on. And cats work too. They worked as rodent controllers, but they did it on their own terms. And so there's some recent discussion about the fact that the way cats have been domesticated is almost beside humans rather than by humans. You know, they benefited from their proximity to us, because our sedentary lifestyle, our storage of grain, meant there were all these rodents around human civilization, and therefore it was a really nice place to be next to. And gradually they kind of moved into our lives when they weren't necessarily asked to. So I guess that's reflected in the way cats tend to live with people these days as well. They tend to do their own thing, to do things on their own terms. And certainly when they're frightened, which I see sometimes in the clinic, they revert to that wild behavior very, very quickly, and much more quickly than a dog would.
Mm-hmm. There also seems to be a rising consumerism around pets. Huge pet warehouses that are selling toys and coats and special food. What do you think about what this says about our pets and about the rise in consumerism?
And to my view, those kinds of expenses are senseless. They're completely about making money. They don't benefit the animals. But there are some things that I think are quite beneficial. For example, high quality foods. We know that premium diets, to a certain extent, can be very good for animals. We're not seeing a lot of the issues with undernutrition that we were seeing. However, we're now seeing quite a lot of pet obesity. So it's about how we as humans engage with those things and use them. There's a lot of marketing around pet products as well. You can get bling on your cat that's designed to cover its anus, so you don't have to look at the cat's anus. You can get Diamante collars. You can get feather down bedding and things like that for animals, which I think is problematic.
It is, especially if your pet has allergies. That was a joke.
Sorry. I laughed silently.
You did. A lot. Most people laugh silently when I tell a joke.
I did.
So this is a difficult question. When is it okay to put an animal down?
That's a question that I get asked a lot. As a clinician, I euthanize animals quite a bit. I'm in a fortunate position where I work in a practice where, in that case, that euthanasia is really being done because I'm preventing further suffering. So I'm usually euthanizing an animal at the end of their life. And many cases in Sydney's inner west, animals are looked after really, really well. And so that's the end of quite a long natural life in many cases. Occasionally, it's a tragic early ending, a young animal that may have been hit by a car and can't be treated, or a young animal that has a terribly rare cancer, something like that. The interesting thing and the difficult thing for vets and pet owners or pet parents or guardians or whatever you want to call them is that there is no minimum standard, minimum quality of life below which you decide this is definitely a case where we need to euthanize the animal. It always boils down to the quality of life of that animal in their lifestyle and their household. You have to think about those things. You may have an animal that could be treated, but the owner is just not able to give the animal the treatments that they need. And therefore, the euthanasia would come a bit earlier than if there were another owner who were quite experienced and able to nurse the animal. So all those factors have to be taken into account.
So what would you say to our listeners who want to figure out how to be a good pet owner? Like, are there three things that we could say to them, like, you know, introduce your pet to your parents, are there things that you would advise? Like, we've got pet owners who are listening, yeah. And if they wanted to up their game in three ways, what would you say?
Well, there's no mandatory standards about who should own a pet. There's no license that you get that gives you qualifications or anything like that. And to some extent, one of the problems in our society is some people feel like pet ownership is a right. Really, it's a privilege. And if you're thinking about owning an animal, it really should be about what's the most appropriate species for you to own, what's the most appropriate breed, what's your lifestyle like, what are you going to be able to give this animal? I think that's the key question you need to ask. And if you can't meet those needs, then that animal isn't for you at this time. For example, it's really common for me to see people who own reptiles and they don't understand that they need UV light. That's really, really important. If they don't have that, they're really going to suffer. So it's never too late to look up the animal welfare needs of an animal that you live with. I think that's really important. The other thing that I would do is reflect on what your animal's life looks like from their point of view. Some people are really uncomfortable about doing this because they feel like it involves anthropomorphism, and anthropomorphism isn't scientific, but actually it's the best place.
What is anthropomorphism?
Right. So it's like assuming that an animal has thoughts and feelings just like us. Mm-hmm. So a bad version of anthropomorphism would be if your cat pees on your clothing and you say, oh, my cat did that to spite me. Because maybe mm-hmm. if your little brother did that, that's exactly why they would do that. But in fact, that's not the case. So that would be a negative version of anthropomorphism. I guess the third thing would be constantly reflect. You are living with a different species on this planet. We don't fully understand everything that's going on in their mind. We can't possibly, but we can do our best, and we can learn. If we realize that perhaps we've been doing the wrong thing in terms of, say, animal training, then it's not too late to pull back and change our behavior. So I think if we can keep an open mind and reflect, change our behavior in the light of new evidence, and that might be because your pet's behaved in a different way to you, or it might be because you've read an article that looks at the science of the way cats behave, try to incorporate that into your behavior.
That's great. We've sort of danced around, but do you live with pets?
I do. I live in fact, they're all former patients. So I like many vets, I passively acquire animals through my work. So I have one four-legged cat who's very old. She's got kidney disease, but as a kitten, she was found crossing Parramatta Road and brought into a vet clinic where I worked. Aww. I have a 14-ish-year-old little rescue dog called Phil, and three budgies. Now, I'm really uneasy about those because they are caged birds, but they were pet birds who were brought in. So I've tried to provide the best environment I can, but I wouldn't choose to have caged birds. I wouldn't purchase them. And I have two guinea pigs as well. The guinea pigs weren't necessarily my choice. I was working in a pet store many, many years ago, and I had to euthanize some very unwell animals at that pet store. And then I turned and I saw this quite sick guinea pig, and I said, well, would you like me to treat this guinea pig? And they said, oh no, it's not worth the money. And I did the terrible thing, and I actually paid them for the guinea pig and took it home. And then, of course, the guinea pig thrived, and so I had to find him a friend, and then thereupon started the chain of guinea pigs, because you shouldn't have them on their own. So you should always have a friend with a guinea pig. So when he passed away, his friend was still around. So his friend needed a friend and so on. Do you have pets?
I don't have pets. I'm not renting a house that is favorable to pets. Mm-hmm. And I always worry about being home enough. Like, you know, I see people who, you know, they leave events and they leave dinners and they go home early to do these things. And it's not that I wouldn't want to.
It is a big responsibility, though. They tie you down in a sense. But I'm quite happy to be tied down in that way.
Well, this has been, if I might say, a very enriching experience for me. And I've learned a lot. Thank you so much for joining us on Open for Discussion, Dr. Anne Fawcett.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you for joining us on Open for Discussion. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or SoundCloud. And you can find me on Twitter at Christopher Neff.
To hear more great stories from the university, check out our Sydney Ideas podcast series. The podcast of our public events program, Sydney Ideas, provides you with the opportunity to hear leading thinkers from our university and around the world. Subscribe today on iTunes and SoundCloud.